But your wife told me you weren't going away.
Now I know.
Back to Australia anyway.
So we have 1 week with which to open Chumash Devarim before we take a bit of a break. And let us begin at the very beginning, because we will see that there's much to speak about thematically as the Parsha unfolds. But as we open the Parsha, and indeed open the Sefer, there is the simplest of questions that needs to be asked regarding the first two words, Eile Hadvarim. Translated, couldn't be simpler. These are the words. The question, of course, is which words are we talking about? And the background to that question is we could divide Chumash Devarim, or certainly, shall we say, most of Chumash Devarim, into two portions. The first three or so prokim are exhortative in nature. They are retrospective. They are Moshe looking back over the last 40 years, discussing certain key events, mishaps. They are not halachic in nature. That's one section. From Perek Dalet, the end of Perek Dalet, there already begins a great deal of presentation of mitzvahs. And there's all sorts of mitzvahs that we will find in Chumash Devarim. There are certain mitzvahs we've met before. There are certain aspects of mitzvahs that are introduced in Devarim, and there are certain mitzvahs which in their entirety are introduced in Sefer Devarim, and those represent the three types of mitzvahs: mitzvahs of Chazoros, mitzvahs Mevuoros, and mitzvahs Chadoshos. And thus, having swept in half a minute or so the content of most of Chumash Devarim, the first four prokim being more tochacha and me being more introspective, and then post that being the content of the mitzvahs, the question then beckons, Eile HaDvarim, which are words of introduction, what exactly are they introducing? And here we will see that opinion is divided on this very basic question amongst the greatest of the Rishonim. If we consult Rashi, which we have done on a number of occasions here at the opening of Devarim, Rashi comments and says, Eile HaDvarim, Lefi Sheim Divrei Tochachos. See, Rashi is responding to the fact that Pasuk Aleph, the very first Pasuk of Chumash Devarim, is nothing more than a name of list of places. Eile HaDvarim Asher Divrei Moshe El Kol Yisrael, Be'eva HaYarden, Bamidbar, Ba'arava, Molsuf, Ben Paran, Ben Tofel, V'lavon, V'chatzeros, V'di Zahav. That is the all of Pasuk Aleph. It's half a dozen places, maybe more. And, of course, the problem is, well, Moshe isn't talking to them in all those places because they are already Be'eva HaYarden. And therefore, if most of these places he isn't talking to them there, he must be talking about things that happened there. But the question is, well, why not talk about what happened there? Why only refer obliquely, in this veiled sense, to the name of the places? Says Rashi, Lefi Shein Divrei Tochachos, because it's words of rebuke. Umanakan kol mekomos shech isu lefnei hamokom vahen. And it mentioned all of the places that they angered HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak. Lefichach sosem es hadvarim v'hizkiram beremez mipnei kvodom shel Yisrael. Therefore, Moshe referred to these places, not these episodes, not explicitly, but rather he mentioned the place and the Hamavin Yovin. And if you're not Maven, so you'll catch it in the rest of Chumash Devarim. We see from Rashi clearly that Eile HaDvarim is an introduction to the words of Tochacha from the very beginning. In the end of Perek Dalet of Chumash Devarim, there will be another introduction, and that's in Perek Dalet, Pasuk Mem Dalet. Which is in Parshas Vayeschanan, Perek Dalet, Pasuk Mem Dalet, V'zos HaTorah, Shosam Moshe Lefnei B'nei Yisrael, words that are familiar to us, introducing Torah. And moreover, Pasuk Mem Hei, Eile Ha'edos, V'achukim V'amishpatim, Hashem Diber Moshe El B'nei Yisrael, B'tzeisam, Mimitzrayim, Be'eva HaYarden, etc. In other words, according to Rashi, there are two introductions to Chumash Devarim. Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph introduces the words of Tochacha, and that will be for approximately four prokim, and then Perek Dalet, Pasuk Mem Dalet, and onwards introduces the content of the rest of Chumash Devarim. From the Ramban, we will see that he takes a different approach. According to the Ramban, Eile HaDvarim is fundamentally introducing the mitzvahs. And indeed, says Ramban, if you look further in Perek, Pasuk Gimel, Vayhi Barbar Mishana, Va'ashteyas HaChodesh, Be'echad LaChodesh, Diber Moshe El Bnei Yisrael, Kechol HaShetziva Hashem Oso Aleihem. Moshe speaks to the Bnei Yisrael regarding things that were that he is commanded to tell them. And Pasuk Hei, Be'eva HaYardin Be'eretz Moav, Ho'el Moshe Be'eres HaTorah Hazos Leimor. He began to explain the Torah. And armed with these psukim, and the Ramban takes them all as one cohesive unit, the opening of Chumash Devarim is essentially introducing the mitzvahs of Chumash Devarim. Now, if that's true, then what are we to make of the fact that from Pasuk Vav until further notice, there are no mitzvahs? According to the Ramban, Moshe Rabbeinu introduced the mitzvahs, he's about to tell the mitzvahs, but he digresses. That is to say, there are certain messages and certain themes that need to be stressed and need to be recapped before they can embark on the content of the mitzvahs. Because unless those messages are heeded and unless those concepts are imbibed in the Bnei Yisrael, so there is little meaning or purpose in giving them more mitzvahs. The first thing they need to do before the shir is to look back on the last 40 years. And here, says Ramban, the question is, to what end? What exactly is Moshe looking to achieve with this preamble, with these four prokim of interruption, essentially, which is a necessary introduction to the mitzvahs that he is to give them? And interestingly, the Ramban says Moshe Rabbeinu's goal is twofold. Firstly, says Ramban, the Jewish people need to look back on the last 40 years and make sure they learn as best as they can the lessons from mistakes that were made by their parents, because they're going into Eretz Canaan and Moshe Rabbeinu will not be with them there. We know certainly, as far as the Ramban is concerned, based on many sources in Chazal, things are much more sensitive in Eretz Canaan. And therefore, if mistakes were made in the Midbar, which is quote-unquote neutral territory, or less meaningful territory, they cannot afford to be repeated in Eretz Canaan, which is very sensitive territory. So every effort has to be invested to ensure that lessons are learned from mistakes made. But secondly, and this is very interesting, this is from the introduction of the Ramban to Chumash Devarim, Moshe Rabbeinu also wants to give them chizuk. Where's the chizuk? Because, says Ramban, if their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu was entirely business-related, and if they don't make the grade, then they are dismissed, they would no longer exist. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu is looking to give them a mixed message, a double message. It's a composite message. On the one hand, you made mistakes, your parents made mistakes, they were punished. But on the other hand, you're still here. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu dealt with the situation in order to make things work. And that's also important, because the background to any tochacha has to be that things can work. If the moral of the story is things can never work, then there's no point in giving tochacha. If the Jewish people, if by the time Moshe is finished with them, if they leave feeling that we're hopeless or useless or we don't have a chance, so they can't enter Eretz Canaan under those circumstances with that attitude. And therefore, on the contrary, says Moshe, V'inchem hayom, here you are. You made a lot of mistakes, and you're still here. Learn from the mistakes, but also learn from the fact that you're still here, because that means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants it to work. And now you can go in, if you know both those things. And he refers to a pasuk which we say in the Yom Neroim, it's in from Shir HaMaalos, Mimamakim, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. It's a very interesting pasuk. Ki imcha haslicha lema'an tivare. HaKadosh Baruch Hu forgives for the purpose of, in order to be feared. So the question is, how does one lead to the other? Which is an interesting shiloh, which we may not ask as we're saying the pasuk. How does one lead to the other? And clearly, it's a causal relationship. Ki imcha haslicha, forgiveness, breeds leman tivare, in order that you should be feared. Says Ramban very simply. Because if HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't forgive, then no one would fear him, because people would just give up. There would be no Yirat Shamayim. There would be no effort invested in trying to become a better Jew, because at the bottom of your heart you feel that it's never going to work anyway. Sooner or later I'm going to make a mistake and it will all be over, so why bother? So amazingly, the greatest contribution to Yirat Shamayim is forgiveness, which means if you're sincere, we can work it out. So that's not an excuse, so keep going. Lema'an tivare. So these are very major themes that are emphasized, and they are the overview of the Ramban for Moshe Rabbeinu's four chapters of Tochacha, and sometimes it's difficult to go over these episodes, but it is worthwhile if these are the lessons that are taken away. That being the case, how does the Ramban relate to the end of Perek Dalet, where the Torah seems to be introducing the mitzvahs? According to the Ramban, it already did so. So the Ramban, for his approach, says, very simply, that having digressed, and Rashi says this, employs this also on occasion, having digressed for so long, as much as initially the Torah introduced the mitzvahs, four chapters later, it reintroduces them. Nachzor al harishonos. And therefore, if we could summarize, and again, I'm not sure if halachically it makes a difference between Rashi's approach and Ramban's approach, it is a pure parshanut, syntactical Torah question. The words Eila Hadvarim are referring to what? According to Rashi, just to summarize, chapter 1, verse 1 introduces the first four prokim, and then the end of Perek Dalet introduces the rest of Devarim. According to Ramban, chapter 1, verse 1 introduces the mitzvahs of Devarim, then there is a necessary, if lengthy, digression, and then they are reintroduced. So, thus far, in very purest pshat terms. It's interesting that in Pasuk Hey, which we referred to before, and we'll see again, there's a fascinating comment of Rashi from Chazal. Be'eve hayarde be'eretz Moav, which is where they are now, Ho'il Moshe be'er es ha-Torah hazos le'mor. Moshe began to explain the Torah. And before we look in Rashi and we ask the question, well, what did he do to explain the Torah? We can only imagine. He added words of explanation, which we know that he did. And Rashi says, be'er es ha-Torah, to explain the Torah, b'shiv'im loshon persha lahem. You know how he explained the Torah? He translated it into 70 languages. That's a very interesting Rashi, because it raises a number of questions. Firstly, we are aware that when it comes to Torah, things tend to lose in translation. So if you translate it into 70 languages, then you lose 70 times over. Moreover, and these are now technical questions or logistical questions, we can speculate, how exactly do the Jewish people know all of the 70 languages? They have enough to deal with. I mean, this is Rosh Chodesh Shvat. There's only 5 weeks. If the first four of them have to be dealt with Ulpan in 70 different languages, just in order to have the Torah translated, where they really understood the original, and most people learn it in a different language because they don't speak Hebrew. And the Jewish people are okay with Lashon HaKodesh. So it's a very enigmatic Rashi, b'shivim loshon per shalehem. Even if they know the shivim loshon, but they know the original. I must say, I came across in the Sefer Shiurei Das of Rabbi Yosef Yehuda Leib Bloch, the Rosh Shiva of Tells, a very interesting approach to this shivim loshon. What is the relationship of the Torah to 70 languages? And moreover, is it possible that there is something that can be added by saying the Torah in another language? After all, it can only ever be a reflection of the original, and if you understand the original, what can be gained? And the Shiurei Das says, the relationship between the language a person speaks and a person's disposition is very telling. There are 70 languages of the world because there are 70 nations of the world. If there are 70 nations of the world, and they all come from the same source, that means that humanity at a root level could actually split up into 70 different types of people. Now, if that's true for the whole of the human race, it may well be true that even an individual coming from the same stock, he may have a certain affinity for all of these 70 different character types, because the human being, the global human being, has 70 different aspects to it, which will express itself in the fact that it splits up into 70 languages. But each and every individual of the human race may well have some type of connection with each of the other 70. Of course, the primacy exists within his own language. Perhaps a moshel. Light, as we know it, contains all the colors, all the primary significant colors. But sometimes it's hard to see it. They're all there, and you actually can't see any of them. If you put them through a prism, and you would see how they split up, all of a sudden you're not seeing anything that wasn't in the original. It's not created now, but it's being drawn out. Now it's less than the original, and it's less than the whole, but it allows you to focus on a certain aspect that exists within the whole. Every language is different because it has different inflections and different nuances, and the extent to which it expresses a different type of personality is a reflection of the fact that it addresses a different aspect of the personality. Says the Shiurei Das, ultimately, Torah is meant to impact on the entire person. And it may well be, and as we know, there are certain languages one can see very clearly how the personality of the host nation is very appropriate, that it speaks a language in that way. There are certain people, they're very easygoing, and their languages, they sprawl out all over the place. Certain people are very punctual, and then their languages are very clipped. And certain people are very dramatic, and the language is very dramatic. And certain people are very boring, and their language is very boring. And in a sense, therefore, the more languages you know, the more you have occasion to distill almost 1/70th of the entire picture and draw on that nuance, draw on that experiential aspect of the language. Because ultimately, it's the person that needs to be affected. If learning Torah were purely an intellectual exercise, you wouldn't need more than one language, because you'll get the point. You'll understand the content. But if it's to be absorbed by the person, you wish to tap into as many aspects of your personality as you can. So as many languages as you speak, the emotional side will come out in one language. The existential side will come out in another language. The philosophical side in another language. And thus, says the Shiurei Das, there was great holistic value in translating the Torah into 70 languages. Not chas v'chalila as a substitute for the original, for Loshon HaKodesh, but as a supplement in order to have the full Torah experience. And so it is. We find in the Gemara, and I heard this from my father, Zichron Levracha, many years ago, the Gemara on a number of occasions brings out a certain meaning from a word in the Torah from a foreign language. It could be from Greek, or it could be from the continent of Africa, and in many different instances, it's as if they say in that nation, in that place in the world, And he explained, if I remember correctly, it was a long time ago, based on a Rashba, that as everyone originally spoke Lashon HaKodesh, Rashi tells us in Parshas Noach, so as everyone split up, each one took a certain aspect of Lashon HaKodesh, and sometimes you see it more pronounced within that language, and it can actually shed light on a compacted meaning within Lashon HaKodesh itself. So this is the approach of Teshivim Lashon from the Shiurei Das. We should mention, side by side, that the Ksava Kabbalah, Rabbi Yaakov Zvi Mecklenburg, has an entirely different approach to the concept of Shivim Lashon here. We understand, we translate literally, Shivim Lashon, 70 languages, and we've said what we've said. But the Ksava Kabbalah says, interestingly, the word Lashon does not always mean language. Shivim Lashon doesn't always mean language. Sometimes the word Lashon refers to a way of understanding something. Let me give you an example. It's a well-known statement of the Gemara. The word ki actually means four things. So says the Talmud on a number of occasions. Ki mishamesh ba'arba lashonos. The word ki can mean four things. Now, of course, the Gemara, watch carefully the words of the Gemara. Ki mishamesh ba'arba lashonos doesn't mean the word ki translates into four languages. Ki mishamesh ba'arba lashonos means the word ki has four meanings. Because the word loshon doesn't always mean a different dialect. Another loshon means another way of looking at it. And says the Ksava Kabbalah, when Chazal say, I believe it's the Sifrei, that's Rashi's source, when Chazal say that Moshe Rabbeinu explained to them the Torah, b'shivim loshon, Ksava Kabbalah says it doesn't necessarily mean 70 languages, it means he explained it to them in 70 different ways. And the truth of the matter is, there is a well-known concept of Shivim Ponim LaTorah. That's everyone knows that. Shivim Ponim LaTorah. What is the source of this idea? Shivim Ponim LaTorah, the 70 ways to explain something. Says the Ksava Kabbalah, the source is here. B'shivim Loshon Pirish Lahem means he gave them the Shivim Ponim LaTorah. That's every different way of understanding the Divrei Torah that he was presenting to them. So these are two quite different approaches to the concept of Shivim Lashon, how each one expands and deepens and enriches the final Torah transmitting experience, Be'ever HaYardi. Now, what I'd like to take a look at for the following few moments is an interesting situation, because there are certain situations where the Torah goes over something, or here Moshe Rabbeinu goes back, and in retrospect, we end up finding out details that we didn't know at the time. And sometimes they can shed a great deal of light on many other matters. I refer us, well, actually, before we take a look to where I want to get to in this week's Parsha, we'll begin by referring to Parshas Kisetse, for there we have the well-known prohibition, Lo Yavo Amoni Umoavi Bikal Hashem. So Amon and Moav, they can convert, but they cannot marry into the Jewish people. Why not? Well, the Torah says, as we know, Al Devar Shelekidmo Eschem Balechem Uvamayim Baderach Bet Eschem Mitzrayim, because they should have brought you food and water when you came out of Mitzrayim. They didn't do that. Especially Amun and Moab, as the Mefarshim explained, they owe their very existence to the Jewish people. They come from Lot. Lot was saved in the merit of Avram Avinu, and therefore they are restricted. Now, thus far we all know. With this in mind, let's take a look at a number of psukim in this week's parsha. Perek Beis, Pasuk Kaf Vav. Now, this is actually taking us back to Parshas Chukas, when they begin to send out delegations to the nations of Eretz Canaan, asking for safe passage through their land. Vo'eshlach malachim mimidbar kedemos, el sichon melech eshbon. Divrei Shalom, I sent a message of peace, which said, Erbrova Artzecha, I'd like to pass through your land. Baderech Baderech, Eleich, we'll stick to the highways, we're not going to get in anyone's way. Lo Asur Yaminu Smol. That's request number one. Safe passage. Number two, Ochel Bakesef Tashbireni Ve'ochalti, please will you sell me food to eat, Umayim Bakesef Titenli Ve'shosisi, and water to drink. Rak Erbrova Aglai, we'll pass through on foot, we won't interfere. Those are our two requests. Pasuk Kaftes. Ka'asher osuli b'nei Esav hayoshvim b'seir v'amoavim hayoshvim b'or. Ad asher avoras hayarden el aretz Hashem Hashem Elokeinu no sein lanu. So just like Esav did, so if you wouldn't mind doing the same, extending the same courtesy, we'd appreciate it very much. As it is, Sichon said no, and the result was the war between B'nai Yisrael and Sichon. Now let's just move back to the point, just to recap what just happened. Moshe speaks to the king of Sichon, sends a message, and says, please, he asks for two things. Let us through your land. We will buy food and water, just like they did the sons of Esav. Now, the sons of Esav are Edom. Now, we happen to know that Edom did not allow them through their land. I mean, that's Beferush in Parshas Chukas. Edom said, Lo tavor bi. No, you cannot come through. Pen b'cher b'tzei l'krosecha. And so B'nai Yisrael had no choice, and they sought an alternative route. So how now is Moshe saying to the king of Sichon, we'd like these two things, please grant them for us, just like Edom did. And that is why Rashi comments and says, on the words, Ka'asher osuli b'nei Esav, lo le'inyan la'avores artzam. This is not a reference to passing through their land, which was denied, but specifically a reference to the second request. Ela le'inyan mecher ochel umayim. So, you can't have everything, but one out of two is not bad. And the point of Moshe is, they sold us food and water, so would you please do the same? They didn't allow us through, which we're asking for, but they did sell us food and water. What's amazing is, if we now join the dots, and we read the pasuk till the end, Moshe says, I'm asking you for safe passage and food and water. Kasher osu li b'nei Esav ayoshvim b'seir v'hamoavim. So this now is very interesting, because Moshe is telling us that not only did Esav make food and water available, but so did the Moavim. How is this to be reconciled with the fact that Moav are barred, as per Parshas Kiseitze, al devar asher lo kidmu eschem balechem uvamayim baderech betzeischem im Mitzrayim? And that's a simple question. Did they or didn't they? Moshe seems to refer to them as yes. The pasuk says no later on. And this is a classic question, and the Rishonim address it, and their answers are many and varied, and I would like to take a look at some of them. We begin with the Ramban. And in fact, for the Ramban, this is part of a broader thesis that he has with regards to Amon and Moab. Let us recap the situation as we know it, and then we'll see if it's so simple. Amon u'Moav, lo yavo Amoni u'Moavi bekal Hashem. Both of them are barred from marrying into the Jewish people. Why? Well, the Torah says, al devar shelo kidmu eschem, balechem uvamayim baderech betzeischem in Mitzrayim. They didn't bring you food and water when you left Mitzrayim. Quite true. The pasuk also goes on to say something else. Vasher socher alecha es bilam ben ba'or me'arayim na'arayim lekal alecha. And he hired Bilam to curse and destroy you. Says Ramban, I have a simple question. Who hired Bilam? If we go back two or three weeks ago to Parshas Balak, we will see that Bilam was hired by Moav, by Balak Melech Moav. What about Amon? Never heard of him. Not mentioned. Doesn't feature there. Wasn't part of it. Midian got involved, as we spoke about last week. Amon are not mentioned in any capacity. So that's interesting. Because how can the Torah bar these two nations based on something that only one of them did? Let's go China. And that is why the analysis of the Ramban is quite different. According to the Ramban, there are two nations that are barred, and there are two reasons given, and the way things fall is that each nation has its reason why it's barred. As if to say, Lo yavo amoni umo avi. Neither of them can come in. Why? The answer is, it depends. With regard to Moab, it's Asher Sochar Lecha Esbilam Ben Boor. That's Moab's problem. That's their issue. What about Ammon? Ammon's issue is, Al Dabar Shelokid Moschem Balechim Mubamayim. And in a sense, what the Ramban has done by splitting them up in this way is he has restricted or isolated the problem of Lokid Moschem Balechim Mubamayim to Ammon, not to Moab. As surely as hiring Bilam was the problem of Moab and not Ammon, so too the other reason, which is Advar Shelokid Moschem, is Ammon and not Moab. And moreover, says Ramban, and with this I understand the Pasuk in Perek Beis very well, which says, he asked Sichon, sell us food and water, just like Bnei Esav did, and just like Moab did. Moab did that. That wasn't their problem. That was Ammon's problem. But Moab was Bilam. So that's a very interesting, and it's all part of his approach to the entire question of Ammon and Moab. Ramban, we should note, however, an interesting ha'ara, which will then breed a further question. But the two reasons that are given in Parshas Ki Tsetse, not giving food and water, and hiring Bilam, grammatically, are not the same. The first one begins, Al devar asher lo kidmu eschem balechem uvamayim, in the plural. Why is it in the plural? We don't know. But then it says, Va'asher sochar alecha es Bilam ben Beor, in the singular. Now, why is that in the singular? Well, we do know, because it was only Moab. It was only one out of the two that hired Bilam. So it's in the singular. But if that's true, then could it be that the Pasuk is telling us that as true as it is that the Bilam issue was restricted to Moab, but the Lokid Moschem Balechem Uvamayim issue was not restricted to Ammon, but rather it's in the plural, because both Ammon and Moab, Lokid Moschem Balechem Uvamayim. That would be a question on the Ramban. But that would then beg the follow-up question, which is, it turns out, on balance, that Moab now have two problems, and Ammon only have one, and they receive exactly the same treatment. So why should that be? Why should Moab have to work twice as hard in order to get disqualified, where Ammon just did it in one go? So these are questions, od chazon lamoed for Parshas Ki Tsetse, but at the very, in the interim, l'inyanenu, should we ask, how can we square the psukim in Parshas Ki Tsetse al devar l'shelokid mu'eschem with this pasuk which says Moab made food and water available? The answer is the pasuk in Ki Tsetse is Ammon, and these are Moab, and in this respect never the twain shall meet. A different response is to be found in another of the Rishonim, the Riva. And the Riva says something very interesting. Everyone is scrutinizing these psukim. For once again, let's ask a simple shaila. We'll read Pasuk Kaftes. Perek Beis Pasuk Kaftes. Kasher osuli b'nei Esav, hayoshvim b'seir. V'hamoavim hayoshvim b'ar. So if you're ever wondering where the Moavim live, now you know, they live in Ar. And if you weren't wondering, you still know. But the Pasuk never talks about them in this way. For example, the Pasuk says, Lo yavo amoni umoavi, or vayar balak ben tzibor melech lemoav ha'isahi. Moav are never referred to by location. Asher ba'ar. Apparently, it's not relevant. And here, they are identified by location. Says the Riva, something very simple may be happening here in the Pasukim. Namely, Moab, as a people, as a whole, did not make food available. There were a certain group of Moabim. Specifically, Hamoavim Asher Ba'ar, there was a certain territory, there was a certain city, which was a relatively small province of Moab, and they did make food available. And Zachor Latov, it happens to be that your average Moabi did not come out. Should we ask speculatively, if you know that someone was descended from the Moavim who lived in Ar, as opposed to greater Moav who lived everywhere else, would that make a difference? Would that impact on the state? That we don't know. But nonetheless, the thrust of what the Riva is saying is that there is no categorical contradiction whereby here it says that Moavim made food and drink available, and later on it says they didn't. That contradiction does not exist. Here it says there was a certain subset of Moab, HaMoavim Asher Ba'ar. Okay, they did. Moab as a whole, Nidon Lefi Rubo, following the majority of Moab, did not make food and drink available. Okay. The Mizrahi, Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi, has a different approach. The Pasuk criticizes Ammon and Moab. Why? Al davar shelekidmo eschem balechem uvamayim. And again, in Peret Beis, Moshe Rabbeinu says, well, the Moavim, they did make food and drink available. Says the Mizrahi, yes, they did. But remember, what is Moshe asking of Sichon? He's saying, ochel bakesev tashbireini, sell me food. And mayim bakesev, I will buy food and drink. Just like I bought from Esav, and just like I bought from Moab. Says the Mizrahi, it's true. Moab sold them food and water. So what's the criticism? The criticism is giving the debt that they owe to the Jewish people, it's not enough for them to sell. They shouldn't have sold. The Jewish people just came out of Eretz Mitzrayim. A certain grace period they deserve to make food available without charging for it. And therefore, with regards to Sichon, who Moshe feels owes the Jewish people nothing, he holds them up as an example of at least do that. But it wasn't enough. It was too little. Because they should have laid it out for you as a gesture of recognition, as a gesture of identification, Hakara Satov. To charge you money at that stage was inappropriate, and it cost them. So says the Mizrahi. It's the question of selling versus giving. And finally, the Abarbanel focuses on the words in Parshas Kiseitze, which says, "Al devar shelakidmo aschem balechem uvamayim, baderech betzeischem mimitzrayim." As if to say, the Abarbanel concedes, perhaps the simple meaning of Perek Beis, which says that they made food and drink available. What was the problem? The problem was, where were they all this time? The Jewish people were at their most vulnerable, at their most delicate, and at their most needy when they just came out of Mitzrayim. That's when they had nothing, they're not established. The man is yet to begin to fall. No one knows what to expect. There's no experience. They're about there through the desert. And that's the point, that Moab should have given them a hand. Once they've already been set, and it's been 40 years already, and then when someone of them gets in touch with you and says, would you mind making food and drink available? Even if you say yes, it's a little late. For the Abarbanel, the wording of the Pasuk is very specific. Timing is everything. Al davar shelokidmu eschem. They should have come to meet you. Baderech betzeischem mimitzrayim. Not when you're pretty much doing well for yourselves and just could do with a bit of a hand. Your needs were much greater earlier on, and you never heard from them. So, on the one hand, once again, as far as Sichon is concerned, it's an example of what he'd like from Sichon, but it is nowhere near enough in terms of what was expected of the name Moab. So it's very interesting because it's tucked into Chumash Devarim, and we're not really expecting a dissertation on Moab until Parshas Kiseitze, but the full discussion cannot exist without being conscious of these psukim, Kavav to Kavtes, of Devarim Perek Beis. Now, I'd like to move from here backwards, so to speak, to Perek Aleph, towards the end of Perek Aleph. And here, Moshe Rabbeinu discusses the Chet HaMeraglim, and this leads us to the psukim of the Lamads of Pasuk Aleph, Perek Aleph. And Moshe goes through all the details of the Chet HaMeraglim, and then there was this decree that they would die out in the Midbar, and only the next generation would go in. Pasuk Lamed Hei. Im Yireh Ish Ba'Anashim Ha'Eleh Hador Hara Hazeh. If any, no member of this bad generation will enter Es Ha'aret HaTovah Shenishbati L'Aseis La'Voseichem. Zulasi Kalev Ben Yefunah Hu Yir'ena B'Lo Atein Es Ha'aret HaShedorach Ba. Except for Kalev and Yehoshua will be mentioned soon enough. So this is a reference to the decree that none of that generation that came out of Mitzrayim would enter Eretz Canaan. Pasuk Lamed Zayin. Gam bi yisanaf Hashem biglalchem lemor. Hashem also got angry at me and said, Gam ata lo tavo sham. You're also not going in. Now, the question is, what is Pasuk Lamed Zayin doing in a discussion of the Chet HaMeraglim? What Pasuk Lamed Zayin is talking about is Moshe Rabbeinu's inability to enter Eretz Canaan, which is based on something that happened almost 40 years after the Chet HaMeraglim. In year number 40 was the Mei Meriva. Yan lo he'emantim bi, lachein lo savo. And here he puts them together, but they're not connected to each other. He's discussing the Chet HaMeraglim, and you couldn't go in, and also me, but that's not material here. It's not related to the Chet HaMeraglim. So why does he mention it here? Leave it until it's time. Says the Ramban, again, it's true. Correct. The reason why Moshe is not able to enter Eretz Canaan is not because of the Meraglim. And therefore, there is no historical connection between the earlier Psukim and Pasuk Lamed Zayin. The connection is thematic. As if to say, what is Pasuk Lamed Zayin doing here that Moshe can't go in? Because he is putting together all of those, each one, albeit for their own reason, each one in their own time, who came to not be allowed to enter Eretz Canaan. So the connection, once again, is not based on that episode. The connection is based on the common verdict of not being able to go into Eretz Canaan. And it's a very enigmatic statement of the Ramban, because at the end of the day, we may say that as true as they got the same decree, but it was for different reasons at different times, and still, why is Moshe mentioning it here? And I wonder whether perhaps one may add a certain further element here. It struck me for the first time this year to my, well, I'm not sure how to feel about it because I've read Parshas Devarim a few times. But if we take a look at the Psukim Kaf Dalet to Kaf Zayin, I found something most unusual. This is Moshe discussing the Meraglim. Pasuk Kaf Dalet, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Kaf Dalet. Vayifnu vayalu hahara. They turned, they went up towards the mountain. Vayavo ad Nachal Eshkol, the ill-fated Nachal Eshkol. Vayiraglu osa. And they spied there. Vayikhu biyadam mipri haaretz. Vayaridu eleinu. They took some of the fruit of the land. Vayoshivu sanu davar vayomru. They gave us a report and said, Tova ha'aretz asher Hashem elokeinu nosei nanu. The land is good. Velo avisem la'alos. And you didn't want to go. Vatamru espi Hashem elokeichem. And you rebelled. Vateirognu ba'aleichem. You complained. And said, Vatomru besinas Hashem osanu hotzi'on emeret v'tzrayim. Lasei sosonu biyad ha'emeru lashmideinu. God hates us. That's why he brought us out. We're going to go to the Emor. We're going to be killed. That's a very brief synopsis of Parshas Shelach. And it is amazing. Why? Because there's something very important missing. Namely, this did not exist in a vacuum. The negative reaction of the Bnei Yisrael didn't come from nowhere. It came from the Meraglim. That's how the whole thing started, as we know. They sent 12 people there. 10 of them came back saying, the fruit is nice, the place is deadly. We don't have a chance. You asked for it, now there's your answer. And the Jewish people were very badly impacted by this. Did they make the right decision? Did they make the wrong decision? We are comfortably able to say they made the wrong decision. That's quite true. But it's amazing that all of that's missing. I'm just reading the psukim. Moshe Rabbeinu says, what did the spies ever do to make you think that the land was bad? They came back, they showed you the fruit, they said it's a good land, and you just went off and started fantasizing that it's a dangerous land. I don't know where you got that idea from. Well, we know where they got it from. They got it from the spies. And Moshe doesn't mention it. How can that be? And I think perhaps that what Moshe Rabbeinu is wishing to convey to the Jewish people here, because the first four prokim are about tochacha. They are about learning lessons and facing up to mistakes. And it's very important, critical in fact, at this juncture, that the Jewish people should not look back on the episode of the Meraglim and lay all the blame on the Meraglim. Because if you do, then it turns out that the chet of the Meraglim, or that whole episode, the blame lies at the feet of 10 individuals and not 600,000. Because what could they do? They were only reacting. What choice did they have but to believe the Meraglim? And as true as that's what happened, and maybe that's how they looked at it, Moshe is saying to them, you can't look at it that way. That's not correct. Because if you do, you are abdicating from the responsibility to have reacted positively, not to have followed the negative report. You should have had a sense of responsibility to know that if HaKadosh Baruch Hu says it's a good land, even 10 people who ostensibly have seen with their own eyes that it's a dangerous land, you should have known better than just to follow them blindly. And therefore, it is a highly conspicuous absence of the input of the Meraglim. Because really what Moshe Rabbeinu is saying is, don't blame it on them. Don't put the Meraglim down to the Meraglim themselves, as if to say, am we the innocent, what could we have done? Let's actually delete them entirely from the equation and focus on you. Now, that is what the beginning of Sefer Torah is about. It's about not passing the buck and just moving to the side so that the blame lands with somebody else. But Moshe Rabbeinu is not here in an antagonistic way. He proceeds to empathize with the Bnei Yisrael. And what does he say? He says, what am I telling you? I'm telling you that you can never say, I had no choice but to react a certain way and absolve yourself of responsibility. That's not true. It's not true for you. That's not true for me. Gam bi hisanaf Hashem biglalchem. I also reacted to you. That's true, by the way. Clear. Had the Jewish people not been so contentious, as we discussed every year and a few weeks ago, as they approached Moshe, where's water, not a word of appreciation, there's no nice tone, certainly no words of condolences for the passing of Miriam, etc., etc. They came belligerent, hostile, and Moshe reacted to them. And he was punished. Hashem said, Yad lo emantibi. You made a mistake. What could Moshe say? I had no choice. Given the situation as it was, they provoked me. And what do you see? Says Moshe, I'm not going in. Just like you. And therefore, says Moshe, it's not from a point of detachment that I say to you that it's never good enough to say that you were provoked. Because I was provoked also by you. And didn't help. And therefore, it's with a great measure of understanding that I say to you that you cannot absolve yourself of the blame by saying you were provoked by the Meraglim. We're not even going to talk about them. We have to focus on you, the Jewish people. So I think that is perhaps a further dimension of what the Ramban means to say by Moshe superimposing his personal decree, even though it came much later. It's thematically related to whether or not you can ever absolve yourself of the blame by saying, well, I had no choice but to react in the way that I did, given the circumstances. A very different approach to this question, and again, it's a very simple question. Moshe is cutting and pasting together two episodes that are not connected. He's talking about the Meraglim, and he brings in his own inability to enter Eretz Canaan, which as far as we know is based on the Me'mariva. It's got nothing to do with the Meraglim, so why does he mention it in that context? And the ensuing psukim, by the way, Lamed Chesed onwards, continue in the Meraglim. So the Rachaim HaKodesh explains that in fact the root reason why Moshe cannot enter Eretz Canaan is because of the Meraglim. How so? Why would it be? Was he involved? No. So why should one lead to the other? Why should he be affected by it? Says the Rachaim HaKodesh, there's a well-known statement in the Talmud in Maseches Tainus, Kaftes Omed Aleph, that this was the very first Tisha B'Av. It was the ninth of Av. When they came back and the Jewish people were crying, and HaKodesh Baruch Hu said, so you're crying over nothing, so the fallout from that will be crying over something. Atem bechisem bechia shel chinam. So this day is now fixed. It's a bechia ledoros. And what that means is that there is a certain significant incompatibility that the Jewish people have with Eretz Canaan, right? As expressed by the fact that they would cry over the fact that God is bringing them there, and that if that is not addressed, it will ultimately express itself in them having to leave the land and work it out in Golos. So the root of Tisha B'Av is the original Tisha B'Av. And the Gezerah of Golos at some point in the future already was in the making. Now the Talmud tells us in Maseches Sota, Daf Tes Amud Aleph, that whatever Moshe did remained. That is to say, he took the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim. They never went back as slaves. And they shouldn't go back. He gave us the Torah. We never lost it. Says the Gemara, if Moshe Rabbeinu had built the Beis HaMikdash, it never would have been destroyed. Moshe Rabbeinu is on the level that whatever he does is absolute. And therefore, had he been the one to build the Beis HaMikdash, it would have been permanent. Now that doesn't sound too bad. It actually sounds quite good. But it could be bad. There is a Perek of Tehillim, Ayin Tes, it begins, Mizmor La'asaf. Elokim, bo'u goyim b'nachal asecha, timu eshecha kodshecha. It's about the churban of the Beis HaMikdash. They came in, they defiled things, and destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. And what's staggering is the fact that the chapter of Tehillim begins with the words, Mizmor la'asaf. When we hear the word Mizmor, we think song, as in joy. And the Medrash Shochet Tov, which is the Medrash on Tehillim, raises the question. How can you say, Mizmor la'asaf elokim bo'u goyim b'nachal asecha? Are you rejoicing? That's what it sounds like. Says the Medrash Tehillim, yet to a certain degree, yes. There is a measure of joy here. How can that possibly be? So the Medrash gives a moshel of a king who made a house for his son, and his son strayed in the course of time, and the king took a hammer and he broke down the house. And in the end, he turned to his servants and said, we should rejoice. Why? Because it was either the house or my son, and I can always get another house. Says the Medrash Tehillim, there is an aspect of Mizmor. Shekila HaKadosh Baruch Hu Chamoso al Eitzim Ba'avonim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, expressed his anger by destroying sticks and stones, but not destroying the Jewish people. If you know where the Jews get their optimism from, that's from Mizmor LaAsaf. The Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, and Asaf says, rejoice. Because there is that silver lining there, and needs to be recognized. If that's true, from a certain point of view, we're in a very delicate situation. Because really what we're saying is, to a certain degree, the survival of the Jewish people could require the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And if that's true, then the Beis HaMikdash has to be built in a way that can allow itself to be destroyed. Because if it is built in this indestructible way by Moshe Rabbeinu, then things being as they are, if there's a non-option to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, the Jewish people will become the objects of God's anger to a much more significant degree, and they may not survive even to be thrown into Golos. So to use very oversimplifying terminology, in order to enable the Beis HaMikdash to be destroyed, which is crucial, should it be necessary for Jewish survival, it cannot be built by Moshe Rabbeinu. And therefore, Moshe says, you sinned in the Egel, pardon me, you sinned with the Meraglim. And that means future Golos is in the offing. Because that's true, Gambi hisanach Hashem biklachem, because of you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I was also party to that anger. I was also impacted by it. Because if you're going to go into Golos, I cannot bring you into Eretz Canaan. And we should know further that there is a sister posuk, so to speak, because here it says, Gambi hisanach Hashem biglalchem. Biglalchem means because of you. In the beginning of next week's parasha, Vayischanan, it says, Vayis aber Hashem bi lema'anchem. Hashem got angry at me, lema'anchem, for you. The difference between biglal and lema'an is biglal is coming away from, it's affected by. Lema'an is the cause of. And there we see the full picture, that ultimately Hashem's anger, so to speak, at Moshe, not to allow him to enter Eretz Canaan, was for the Jewish people. Lema'anchem, not biglalchem anymore. Lema'anchem. And thus, says the Aruch Haim, we understand, Moshe didn't sin in the chet of the Meraglim. But given what happened, and what was set in motion as a result of the Meraglim, Moshe can't go in. Now there's one question outstanding, and that is, as we know it, the reason or the cause for Moshe's inability to enter Eretz Canaan is because of the Mei Meriva. According to what the Aruch Haim is saying, and his understanding, his reading of the pasuk here, it's much earlier. Why does Hashem say, because you hit the rock or whatever happened, so that's why you can't go in? So the Aruch Haim says a great chiddush, which he repeats a number of times throughout his parish on the Chumash, and that is, had things gone well by the rock, with this new generation, it could be that they could have rehabilitated themselves from the chet of the Meraglim and been able to deal with their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and everywhere that he is taking them to, fundamentally, so that Golos would no longer need to be an option. Had Moshe Rabbeinu not hit the rock, the Jewish people would have returned to a level and the climate would have returned, which would have made it possible for Moshe to bring them in there at Canaan. Because that didn't happen, there was a certain recovery that was possible that in the end did not occur, and at that point it became final. Lachein lo taviyu es bnei Yisrael es el haaretz. So that's the approach of the Aruch Haim HaKadosh, quite different than the Ramban. And I would like to conclude just for a moment or two by talking about a day, it's a few days away, it may yet not happen if things don't change, so that's Motzei Shabbos. And I believe that a certain perspective on Tisha B'Av is connected to our remarks at the beginning of the Parsha, whereby the Ramban says that the goal of Moshe looking back at these 40 years is twofold. On the one hand, it's to recognize the issues that need to be addressed, but on the other hand, it's to reinforce within the Jewish people the sense of their eternity, the sense of the fact that of the absoluteness with which HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants the relationship with them, and will do what needs to be done in order to for that to be maintained. And the truth is that we have both themes echoed within Tisha B'Av. On the one hand, there is no question that Tisha B'Av is a day of reflection, and from that point of view, and again, everything is backwards, because we don't say Tachnun on Tisha B'Av. How can we not say Tachnun on Tisha B'Av? The pasuk says Kara Alai Moed Ishbor Bachurai. And as soon as you hear Moed, I mean, that's got to be selective hearing at its worst. As soon as we hear the word Moed, that sounds like a Yom Tov, so we don't say Tachnun. How can it be? It's a dark day. But the answer is, if the day is used for what it could be used, it could bring a turnaround that leads to the greatest of Yomim Tovim. It requires an honest appraisal of things that are not as they should be. Moed is a meeting place. We need to come face to face with certain realities. And if we do, it really is a Moed. It's not a Moed in the conventional sense, but it has every aspect, every value of the meeting aspect of a Moed. So those are things that need to be reflected on. It's a stark day of stocktaking. But on the other hand, there is a certain theme that runs through even Eicha. And there is no greater expression of the tragedies than Eicha. But the final pasuk of Eicha, it has this theme to it. After Ashiveinu Hashem Elecha v'Nashuva, so that is the penultimate pasuk. But the final pasuk says, Ki im ma'os ma'astanu kotzafta aleinu ad ma'od. And then we say Ashiveinu again. What is the meaning of that pasuk? So the Rashba explains, Mius and Ketzef, disgust and anger, are two separate things. They're two antithetical things. How so? Because when you're disgusted with something, you leave it alone. You don't have anything to do with it. You're only ever really angry at someone who you are connected with. And that's why you're infuriated that things aren't working the way they should. If you don't care about them, so you don't care even enough to get angry. So the Eicha ends in the most amazing way. Because it's terrible, terrible things. And in fact, they're so terrible that the Navi Yirmiyahu says, so that means that we're still connected. Because if you were disgusted with us and rejected us, you wouldn't have gotten so angry. Ki ma'os ma'astanu, if you were just mo'es in us, you got way too angry for that. Katsafta aleinu ad ma'od. And therefore, and it's important for the Navi to underscore this within the Jewish people. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has been way too angry with the Jewish people if for it to be over. Because if it was over, then there's no connection. And as we know, when the Jewish people are at the top, they're at the very top. And when they're at the bottom, they're at the very bottom. And so these two things go hand in hand. What do we when we look at the history, which is unlike the history of any other nation, not only should the Jewish people not exist anymore, but certainly they shouldn't exist in the way that they do, always outsized, for better or for worse. And sometimes there are difficulties and we need to address them. But the moral of the story, Shivtecha u'mishantecha, heima yinachamuni, both the staff to rely on, and even the rod to hit, both of them have an aspect of nechama, because both of them are way too extreme to be normal, which means that our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, our supernormal relationship, is still there. And it's interesting, and again, at the end of Tisha B'Av, the Shabbos after Tisha B'Av, Shabbos Nachamu, asks Rav Ehrentor of Munich in the Komitz HaMincha, why do we have Shabbos Nachamu? What are we taking comfort from? If Mashiach comes, so then do Nachamu. And if he doesn't, so why Nachamu? Nothing happened. What are you taking comfort for? Says the Komitz HaMincha, if Tisha B'Av is used to look back at the year in a way that at the very least reinforces our awareness that our connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu was still there, that's already a Nachama on an annual basis. because it keeps us going, and if we didn't make it this year, so we'll make it next year. So even Tisha B'Av itself, it's so unusual, it has to be the source of a nechama, because it reminds us that we're not to blend in with everyone else. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has different plans for us, and if he has plans for us, he's gotten angry at us. But Chotu B'Kiflayim, Loka B'Kiflayim, Mitzah Hashem B'Karav Yisnachamu B'Kiflayim. Just to mention again,